Welcome to EncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. EncLive On Air is a podcast from EncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, EncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Deciphera Pharmaceuticals, we had the pleasure of speaking with Tanios S. Bakai-Saab, MD, Suzanne George, MD, and Margaret Von Mehren, MD. Bakai-Saab is the Medical Director of the Cancer Clinical Research Office and the Vice Chair and Section Chief for Medical Oncology in the Department of Internal Medicine at the Mayo Clinic, as well as the leader of the Gastrointestinal Cancer Program at the Mayo Clinic Comprehensive Cancer Center. George is a senior physician and the director of clinical research in the Sarcoma Center at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, as well as an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Von Mehren is chief of the Division of Sarcoma Medical Oncology, vice chair of the Department of Hematology Oncology, physician director of the Clinical Trials Office, and associate director of clinical research at Fox Chase Cancer Center. In our exclusive interview, Drs. Bakai-Saab, George, and Von Mehren discuss key efficacy data and patient-reported outcomes from the Phase 3 INTRIGUE trial, which evaluated ripretinib versus sunitinib in patients with advanced gastrointestinal stromal tumors who were previously treated with imatinib. Dr. Bakai-Saab also shared the rationale for a Phase 1-2 study investigating the novel ULK inhibitor DCC-3116 alone or in combination with trametinib in patients with advanced or metastatic RAS or RAF-mutated solid tumors. Additionally, Drs. George and Von Mehren highlighted how vimseltinib, which is being investigated in tenosynovial giant cell tumors in the Phase 3 MOTION trial, could alleviate unmet needs in the TGCT population.
Thank you so much, Dr. Saab, for taking the time to speak with me this afternoon. Starting with updates in gastrointestinal stromal tumor, we saw abstract 359881 that was presented in January of this year as part of the ASCO plenary series, of course, the INTRIGUE trial, a Phase 3 randomized open label study that evaluated ripretinib versus sunitinib in patients with advanced GIST previously treated with imatinib. Can you discuss the results that were reported in early January?
Yeah, absolutely. GIST has become such an amazing disease to treat. This went from a disease that universally was lethal to more of what we call a chronic cancer for most patients, you know, living for years and years and years in the metastatic setting. And imatinib is the one that moved the field forward. And then came multiple agents, sunitinib and regorafenib and others, including ripretinib in the fourth line. And ripretinib looked very, very interesting in the later lines. The response rate and outcomes were somewhat more than one would expect that line of therapy. Now, ripretinib is a broad spectrum inhibitor that hits both KIT and PDGF or ELF through switch control tyrosine kinase mechanism. And it's already approved, we know, for GIST to receive prior treatment with three or more TKIs, including imatinib. And the thought with this INTRIGUE study is, can we take those very interesting results from essentially a later line of therapy to replace sunitinib in the second line? Sunitinib is active, but it's an incredibly tough drug. And frankly, you know, anything that would displace sunitinib in that line of therapy would actually be a welcome addition. So this was a large study. INTRIGUE was a Phase 3 randomized open label study and looked at the efficacy and safety of ripretinib versus sunitinib in patients with GIST who failed prior imatinib. This study essentially had patients randomized 1-to-1 to ripretinib with a dose of 150 once daily or sunitinib at 50 milligrams every day using the 4 weeks on, 2 weeks off regimen. Many of us do use the 37.5 daily, but 50 is the one approved by the FDA. You know, randomization was, of course, stratified by KIT mutational status and imatinib intolerance. That study had for a primary endpoint progression-free survival, and then, you know, the other endpoints were response and overall survival and others. There was also, you know, some hierarchical testing performed for the primary and key secondary endpoints with looking at KIT exon 11 and the general population. And this study's data cutoff was September 2021. Unfortunately, you know, the study, at least from the statistical sense, came back negative. So PFS was not statistically different between ripretinib and sunitinib, which is a relative disappointment because we're really rooting for ripretinib, and mostly because of its toxicity profile, which I'll get to in a little bit. I mean, this was powered for superiority. The reality is when we look at these exon 11 subgroup of patients, which is, again, we have to be careful, this is a secondary endpoint, the improvement with PFS was numerically better for ripretinib versus sunitinib. It was 8.3 versus 7. And when you look at the overall population, it was about the same. So it seems like it performs a little bit better with the exon 11, although again, did not hit the statistical significance. The one point I find interesting is the response rate was a little bit higher, although, you know, I was hoping for a little bit higher than that, but it was 24% of patients actually had a response to ripretinib versus only 15% with sunitinib in that exon 11 component, a little bit higher with the overall population. We don't have data yet on overall survival because it was not reached in either arm. So this essentially is continues to go. I mean, it just tells you how well these patients are doing in terms of their generalized outcome. Now, the one thing about ripretinib is exactly what we expected, is that it will have less toxicities, less grade 3 and 4 toxicities. Versus sunitinib, it was about 40% versus close to 65% for grade 3 and 4 toxicity. So 40 for ripretinib, about 60-65% for sunitinib. And overall, you know, ripretinib had less treatment emergent toxicities, less PPE, which is again one of the advantages of ripretinib. With sunitinib, you get quite a bit of palmar-plantar erythrodysesthesia, also less neutropenia. So overall, you know, the study was negative, unfortunately, although there were some hints that, you know, ripretinib, especially in the exon 11 mutations, may do better. But I think the most meaningful finding here was that with ripretinib, indeed, you don't lose benefit. If anything, there's a slight numerical gain, at least, with exon 11 patients. But I think the more important finding is actually that the patients do indeed end up with a less grade 3 and 4 toxicities with ripretinib after imatinib failure. So overall, I think, again, unfortunately, this is a negative study. It will not get ripretinib to the second line. Although, again, the hints were there that it could be a reasonable agent to use in this setting. But given the results of this study, you know, ripretinib remains for more TKI refractory patients.
Now, given that we're still waiting to see the overall survival, do you think investigators are holding out hope in that regard? Or,
yeah, I mean, that's a great question. It's always great to see some survival data. And so we don't know where the survival is going to end up and whether that's going to be much of a difference between the two. But yes, I mean, if the survival appears to point more and more towards ripretinib versus sunitinib, you know, it could potentially continue to make a case for considering our options. You know, we're going to be limited by the fact that this is not approved in this setting. But I do think that, you know, for some patients where I don't think sunitinib is a good option, it could be a good alternative. But the survival data would certainly help. So the survival could be similar, could be a little bit better. But I hope it doesn't look any worse, because if it's worse, which I don't anticipate it would be, just an anticipation, then you can't really consider this as an option. But if it's a little bit better to about the same, you know, it would keep, I think, ripretinib as an option in the pocket if needed in earlier lines post-imatinib.
And we talked about the safety profile of the regimen, but from a patient's perspective, what do we know about patient-reported outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, overall, there's definitely data from later lines of therapy that does suggest that ripretinib is favorable in terms of its effects on quality of life. You know, sunitinib, I can tell you from experience, with this disease, sunitinib is tough. I mean, it definitely does affect quality of life of the patients. The hand and foot syndrome, the fatigue are pretty limiting for sunitinib, and it tends to be a rough drug, frankly. It's not one of our favorites by any means. And so from that standpoint, I think one of the main reasons why ripretinib was a good consideration for this type of trial is exactly because the thought was this will improve the toxicity profile, the quality of life of patients, while we were hoping would improve outcomes, which unfortunately it didn't appear to, except maybe slight numerical advantage in the exon 11 patients.
And then what can you tell us about the effect of hepatic impairment on the pharmacokinetics of ripretinib?
There was some work done on the effect of hepatic impairment on the pharmacokinetics of ripretinib. And at this point of time, you know, it does appear that at least in the presence of mild hepatic impairment, there was no impact on the total PK. But when you start looking at moderate and more severe hepatic impairment, there's certainly an increase in the AUC of ripretinib and may actually end up with more toxicities. There aren't any dose recommendations yet developed for moderate to severe hepatic impairment. So we're waiting on additional data there. But at least, you know, one may say that with those patients with mild hepatic impairment, there doesn't seem to be much effect on PK, and so the dose can stand.
And then turning to research with ULK inhibitors, can you share some light on the phase 1-2 study that's being done with DCC-3116 as a single agent and in combination with trametinib in patients with advanced or metastatic solid tumors harboring RAS or RAF mutations?
Yeah, you know, RAS and RAF mutations are some of the main drivers for most cancers, frankly. And in GI, certainly with colon, with pancreas, they tend to be major drivers. You know, in colon, probably between the two, you're going to hit about 40% of the patients. In pancreas, we're talking about 90%+ of patients. And so targeting the RAS family of oncoproteins makes quite a bit of sense. And, you know, one of the effects that I thought that with this RAS family of oncoproteins, which are the most commonly mutated, there is a requirement for autophagy for tumor growth and survival. And, you know, as you know, RAS does activate the signaling through the MAPK pathway and therefore regulates cell survival in that sense. Kinases that are relevant to the process are these ULK1 and 2 kinases. And inhibition of the MAPK pathway does release tonic inhibition of ULK1 and 2. And therefore, when that happens, that ends up triggering autophagy as a survival mechanism. So it is possible that ULK1 and 2 may provide a promising therapeutic target based on that preclinical data. And then DCC-3116 is a potent and selective ULK inhibitor that does appear to show preclinical anti-tumor activity, especially when you combine it to the MAPK kinase inhibitors such as trametinib, and some data was presented at the AACR-NCI-EOTC meeting in 2019. And this led to the development of a phase 1-2 multicenter study looking at DCC-3116 as a single agent and in combination with trametinib. Of course, you know, the combination with trametinib is the one that's most exciting, but it's important to understand what the value of single agent would be. Ultimately, you know, once they go through the phase 1, they will move to essentially pancreas cancer, non-small cell, colorectal, or melanoma. I mean, these are cohorts separated by essentially a disease site. But we know that these cancers are driven by elements in the RAS-RAF pathway, such as RAS, NBRAF, and others. And so we're looking forward. This study will enroll up to, I think, a little bit more than 100, 120 patients. And we'll look forward, you know, for this novel way to target the MAPK pathway, which, as I said, you know, is a very relevant, you know, pathway, at least from the GI standpoint in colorectal and pancreatic cancer.
Thank you, as always, for your insights.
Anytime.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Von Mehren and Dr. George, for taking the time to speak with me on an episode of OncLive On Air to discuss research with ripretinib and GIST and vimseltinib and TGCT. How are you both doing today?
I'm fine. Great to be here. Agree. Doing well. Thank you for the opportunity.
Of course. Anytime. All right. So starting with GIST, we saw abstract 359881 that was presented earlier this year in January at the ASCO plenary, the INTRIGUE trial, which of course evaluated the efficacy and safety of ripretinib versus sunitinib in patients with advanced GIST previously treated with imatinib. So Dr. Von Mehren, to start, what are your thoughts on the updated data and what do you see their effects being on practice patterns?
So the study's primary endpoint was to see was ripretinib superior than sunitinib in this study population. And it was not. Many of us in the community were surprised by that. But it certainly, at least based on, you know, the progression-free survival plots, didn't look to be inferior. And so I think in terms of practice patterns, you know, I don't know that it's changed the standard of care, but it does provide some data to support its use in this setting for patients who might have a contraindication to sunitinib. I don't know, Suzanne, Dr. George, if you have your take on the data.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that the PFS, the progression-free survival curves for ripretinib and sunitinib were nearly overlapping when you look at the Kaplan-Meier curves. And just as you said, the study was designed to show superiority of ripretinib. And in that sense, it did not show superiority, but the outcomes were very similar. And I think it does put some sort of food for thought, particularly in situations where people might have a contraindication to a VEGF inhibiting kinase inhibitor based on the toxicity profile of the agents. I think the other interesting thing was that sunitinib seemed to do a bit better than it had in the pivotal study that initially led to its approval, which I think is really a reflection of how we learn to use drugs better over time, how we learn to manage toxicities over time, and perhaps even some differences in patient populations at the time of study accrual in terms of disease burden and advanced nature of the disease at the time the study was enrolled, different when there were no prior therapies other than imatinib compared to now. So I think it really gave us a lot of food for thought.
And of course, we're seeing more patient-reported outcomes being incorporated into clinical trials across oncology, and we did see that as well with INTRIGUE. What do we know now about the tolerability of these agents, Dr. George?
I want to say that I think that the investigator team, the academic and sponsor team on this study did a really great job of not only incorporating the patient-reported outcomes into the study, but actually analyzing them and reporting on them. Because as you said, they are often in trials, but it's not that often that you actually see the results so early on. So I think there's a big congratulations there for the study. And what we saw was that participants who were randomized to ripretinib tended to maintain their general sense of wellness by several measures while on the drug, which I think is good news. Folks who were randomized to sunitinib perhaps had more of an impact in their overall quality of life measures on the drug. And that's likely a reflection of the difference in toxicity profiles of the two agents.
Yeah, I think one of the things that, you know, we know about sunitinib, it can, because of its VEGF targeting, really can be associated with high blood pressure and also the hand-foot syndrome, which for many patients can be problematic. Also, we tend to see more diarrhea with sunitinib than ripretinib. Ripretinib does have sort of some unique toxicities in the sense that we do recommend patients be seen by dermatologists because we occasionally do see some skin findings and some can be cancers, although that's uncommon. And then patients on ripretinib also have the experience of oftentimes having hair loss, which is very different from most tyrosine kinase inhibitors and something that patients really need to be educated about so that they're prepared.
And would you say that either agent's safety profile would sway you in terms of the agent that you would recommend ultimately, or are the adverse effects manageable at this point?
I think there are some patients in whom, because of bad cardiovascular disease or a history of stroke, where I might be concerned about the risk for high blood pressure. Some frail patients where if there were diarrhea, I'd be more concerned about them, where Sutent might not be the ideal drug, and where, just in my experience, I've found ripretinib to be oftentimes an easier drug for patients to handle. I don't know, Suzanne, if you have other particular patient populations that you think about one drug versus another in.
Yeah, no, I would feel similarly. I think that, you know, as Dr. von Meeren said right at the beginning, the study showed similar outcomes. Ripretinib did not show superiority to sunitinib. So I think the standard of care still remains sunitinib as the second line therapy, but there may be unique patients where the toxicity profile could be prohibitive for sunitinib. Just as she said, you know, elderly, frail, refractory hypertension, you know, people that are already on multiple antihypertensives and don't have well-controlled blood pressure, you can still see hypertension with ripretinib, but it's not to typically the same degree that you see with sunitinib. Things around that toxicity profile. Generally, though, I'm still sticking with sunitinib as second line, but if there's a real contraindication based on toxicity, I think it's worth a discussion.
How might hepatic impairment affect dosing and patient selection for ripretinib?
So it looks like, you know, there was at least one study that suggested that mild hepatic impairment did not necessarily require dose modification, but more moderate hepatic impairments may indeed lead to increased exposure of the drug. And so as of right now, there are no specific dosing guidelines, but those are being developed. And it very well may be that moderate hepatic impairment requires a lower dose. But the specific guidance on that is still in evolution, I believe.
So then switching over to TGCT, we saw data with the agent vimseltinib for the treatment of TGCT. What unmet needs exist in this space, Dr. von Mayren, and how could the agent potentially meet them?
So TGCT is a disease entity that for many years has been handled by orthopedic surgeons. Patients present with painful joints. Oftentimes they're managed with anti-inflammatories. There are times when surgery is done to sort of remove this neoplasm, which typically is a locally aggressive process, not one that is metastatic, and that can help with symptom management. Biologically, we know that these tumors can respond to CSF inhibition, and there have been a variety of studies that with drugs that target this pathway that have shown that they can decrease the size of these lesions. In my mind, you know, patients who have had prior surgery and are felt not to be surgical candidates or maybe can't undergo surgery are clearly candidates for this type of an approach. But I think our sort of the evolution of how to use these drugs and where they fit in with management is, to my mind, still an ongoing question.
No, I would agree. It is a challenging disease. And I think identifying the patients in the clinical settings that systemic therapy, drug therapy is indicated is important. I think that it is encouraging that there are drugs that are being developed in this space that may have favorable toxicity profiles, because anytime you're using an agent that might need to be used over the longer term, it's always a balance of side effect, you know, risk and benefit. You know, what are the toxicities and what are the benefits? And particularly in situations like this, it's important to keep that balance intact.
Coming to a close here, is there any ongoing or planned research at either Fox Chase or Dana-Farber in either field that you would like to call attention to?
Currently at our institution, we don't have any studies in TGCT. We do have some studies that are looking at agents in advanced GIST for sort of refractory patients. There are some new drugs that are being developed, which we're participating in phase 1 and phase 2 clinical research, as well as a study that's going to be looking at a combination of sunitinib with CGTT that has been previously studied in the phase 1 setting by Dr. George's colleague, Dr. Wagner, and looking to see its benefit in earlier lines of therapy.
Yeah, and it's similar in our center as well. We actually do have several studies. We have a couple studies in TGCT that my colleague, Dr. Andy Wagner, is running. And we also have similar new studies in GIST looking at novel first-in-human phase 1 compounds in advanced GIST. Very similar to what Dr. von Mayren is saying. And it's actually really nice because we're working collaboratively on a number of these projects. You know, when imatinib, sunitinib, regorafenib were first developed, you know, they were developed in other diseases first and then applied to GIST. But now we're in a place where the biology of GIST is better understood and drugs are being developed for GIST from the first in human experience. And that really puts us in a position for shorter timelines to the development of new options in this disease area. So I'm excited about what's coming, what we're working on and what's coming ahead.
Great. I think that was wonderful. Thank you both so much.
Okay, great.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Deciphera Pharmaceuticals. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Onc Live On Air.